This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Well, it's, of course, the election season. We've been talking a lot about that, but there are other things we talk about quite a bit, especially if we've got kids. We talk about education, for example. And today we're going to talk with Jack Russell Weinstein. He's the host of Public Radio's Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. And it plays this Sunday at 5 Central right here on the Prairie Public Network. Jack, education is your subject this week.
It is, and it's actually one of my favorite subjects. We've had a handful of episodes on education, and I do a lot of work on my own research. It's fascinating because it's the place where everything meets. Our family, our politics, our pleasures, our anger. It's just education and schooling. We all go through it, and so everyone has feelings about it, both positive and negative.
It's the most important human enterprise on the planet, I guess.
I think that's right.
Jack, give us a description, though, of your upcoming show. What kind of look at education does it take?
So we're asking a very particular question. We're asking whether or not kids have a right to an education. And so what that means is, if the state, meaning the government, doesn't provide an education, can people complain? Can people sue? Is education just a privilege? Is it something that you earn by studying or whatever? Or is it something that, by virtue of being an American citizen, you are entitled to? And if you don't get it, if they don't teach you to read, if you don't have access to schools, if you can't get an education, are you being wronged? And that's a question you don't hear very often, or at least not framed in that way.
So what are the philosophical arguments for public education?
Well, there are a variety. The first, having to do with what you just said, is it's perhaps the most important human endeavor. We are nothing without education. We think about education in terms of reading textbooks and writing papers, but of course, learning how to cook requires a certain kind of education, and learning how to interact with others, learning how to look at yourself and take care of yourself. And kids, from a very early age, do that both at home and in institutions. They do it in their religious institutions. They do it in public institutions and of school. Of course, they do it in school. So the first argument is you need it. And if you can't get it, you are not a human, not a full human being in that sense. The second argument has to do with the fact that we live in democracy, right? That part of self-governance is being able to argue, being able to critically analyze things, being able to listen to other people's opinions and learn from them. And so we can't have a democracy if we don't have education. And so those two things, the humanness of it and the democracy that we live in, suggest that there is a moral obligation for the government to provide us an education, but is there a legal obligation? Is it in the Constitution? Is it in the law? That's the question that we want to ask.
What about the philosophical questions that circulate around what we teach?
Well, those are huge questions. We didn't really get into that in this show, although I've talked about it a lot on previous episodes, but that's huge, right? I mean, think about something controversial like sex education. There are people who think that you should give very straightforward, very practical, strategic advice as to how to protect yourself. There are some people who think that should extend to how to know what good pleasure is and how to give other people pleasure. And then there are people who think, no, we should teach people not to have sex. We should teach abstinence. And those three points on the spectrum are hugely controversial because they relate to people's entire worldview about what they think about intimacy, where intimacy should take place, what an ideal relationship is. Think also about a question, how do we teach someone like George Washington? Do we teach the real person who made real mistakes, or do we teach that he chopped down a cherry tree and never told a lie? Do we teach heroes as if they are perfect so that no one can achieve that greatness but they have something to aspire to? Or do we teach heroes as normal people who model activity that we ourselves can engage in? So virtually every aspect of education can be controversial. It just depends on how far we want to dive in.
Well, the form of education that we typically have and experience in this country is a room that has a number of students in it and an instructor. And that sort of gets to the issue of
How individual should education be? Should it be this generic kind of education? We get 30 people in a room and we share the same information. Or should it be focused on the individual learning potential of each student?
I think that's right. Differentiation, which is what they call it in education circles, is about knowing what each child is able to do and what each child should do. And the more children you have in the classroom, the harder it is to differentiate. So if you have a classroom of five people, then the teacher has a better sense of who can do what. But if you have a classroom like we do in North Dakota of 25, 30, 35 students, then how does the teacher know who's doing what? How does the teacher know who got good sleep the night before or who has done the reading? So this practice of differentiation is itself a practical problem, but then there's the more curricular problem, the more theoretical one, which is suppose Sally's parents want her to learn about evolution and Bill's parents don't. What do you teach in the classroom and how do you cater to parents' individual needs and wants? And how do you say to Sally's parents and Bill's parents, no, you're wrong. You have this desire to teach, to have your child learn something, but we as the government say, no, there are things that everyone has to learn even if parents don't want them to, and we are going to teach those as well. So what it means to individuate in a class is both about differentiating their skills, but also recognizing where they come from and when the parents have a say and when they don't.
And when we talk about public education, there was a time when there was a big debate over whether or not kindergarten should be part of that. Now the debate is over, you know, early childhood education, pre-kindergarten, and whether or not public education should go beyond 12th grade.
I think that's right. And there's also conversations about how long the school year should be. There are some people who think that school should go all 365 days. There's some people who think that the school day should go longer. There's some people who think – I read this wonderful book that I'm going to be teaching again next semester called Spark about exercise in the brain. And what this person argues is that every child should start by going to gym class, that the beginning of every day should be intense exercise because that primes the brain to learn more. So imagine that controversy alone. Everyone should start with gym class. I think most people would find that not disagreeable, but just kind of shocking. And so every aspect of education, every change to the institution has been a struggle to achieve. Some of those have been worthwhile struggles, and I suspect some of those have not.
Well, we have, of course, this agrarian schedule for education in most of the country, 9 months, you know, in school and then 3 months to plant and harvest and all that kind of stuff. And we also start school pretty early in the morning when there's lots of research that indicates that kids – teenagers in particular need lots of sleep and aren't necessarily at their best at 7 in the morning.
That's absolutely right. If we were to cater high school to teenage brains, high school probably wouldn't start until 1 in the afternoon. It wouldn't involve sitting in a seat for 8 hours. And there would be a lot more physical activity. There'd be a lot more social interaction. But part of the issue, and this comes up in the discussion in the show, is that part of the issue is controlling teenagers. We as a culture, we're pretty afraid of teenagers. We're afraid of teenage rebellion. We're afraid of teenage sexuality. We're afraid of teens getting themselves into trouble and of becoming more adult than maybe we think they should be at 15, 14, or even 13. And so a lot of the structure of the classroom and the structure of the school is about controlling them. And so then the question becomes, is this a violation of their rights? Do kids have the same rights to freedom of speech that adults do? Do kids have the same rights of freedom of association that adults do? How can a school punish a kid? If a school punishes a kid and, let's say, expels the child, who do you go for to argue against? Who do you go to recourse? And one of the things that our guest, Derek Black, a professor of law at the University of South Carolina, argues is the courts have been incredibly reluctant to get involved in these discussions. They like to say schools are parent substitutes. We don't want to second guess schools. So however schools decide to punish people, that's acceptable as long as they, you know, have a very basic process of telling the student why and et cetera, et cetera. But that means that you get these things like zero tolerance policies, which end up doing really absurd things. We had a conversation during the episode about a kid who took his friend's knife away because she was suicidal. And then that kid, the boy who took the knife away, was suspended for having a knife in school. And that's because there's a zero tolerance policy. He had a knife in his locker. The fact that he had the knife because he took it away from a friend who was going to be suicidal, the fact that he did the right thing, and the principal actually said, I know you did the right thing. It doesn't matter. We have to suspend you. So how do you deal with that as well? Is this about education? Clearly not. It's about control. So does that undermine our education system? That's part of the discussion.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life. You can hear it on Prairie Public's radio network this Sunday at 5 Central. And Jack's guest is Derek Black, who's a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. And as Jack mentioned, he writes and talks about the right to education, literacy, and the injustice of zero tolerance policies at schools. Jack Russell Weinstein, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug, as always.
More Main Street in a moment.
Who defines what normal looks like? Psychologist Andrew Solomon's research of children diagnosed with deafness, Down syndrome, autism, dwarfism, and more challenges the dynamics of what a regular family looks like. You can meet the author of the book and award-winning documentary Far From the Tree on October 13th at the Game Changer Ideas Festival. More information can be found online at GameChangerND.com.
Well, there's that wire machine in the background reminding us that it's time for a couple of vintage news hounds to talk about the big stories of the week. Dave Thompson always joins me, although usually it's on Friday. Today, Thursday, we're talking to Dave because, you know, news happens and stuff like that.
It does, and then I've got a meeting in Minneapolis this weekend, so.
Well, let's talk about yesterday, which was pretty newsy to me in the sense that October 10th isn't when I expect a lot of snow and winter to arrive.
And especially when you're talking about a foot or more of snow. The National Weather Service says with these, you know, late fall storms or early winter season storms, you get these bands of heavier snow. And you had a real band of foot and above snow. And it was just something else. 17 inches of snow was the biggest total that I saw. And it was a lot of snow. And there was a no-travel advisory in parts of, you know, that east, south, central North Dakota, Valley City South. And then there were some travel problems in the Grand Forks area as well because this was a snowstorm that I don't think anybody really thought we'd get dumped on like that, but we got dumped on.
Well, consider this. The Weather Service is saying that today's expected high temperature of 34 in Fargo could be the lowest high on record for this city for this date.
Can you believe that?
No, yes. I don't want to believe
that. I know. But there is some good news in the forecast next week. The things that I've seen from the National Weather Service looks like we could see 40s and maybe close to 50 next week.
Well, that's got to be encouraging news, particularly for people who've got stuff in the fields yet. I mean,
absolutely.
Soybeans and sugar beets, maybe some corn out there.
That's right. And you worry about that, yeah.
Well, we were going to go to Sauerkraut Day yesterday, Ashley Thornburg and I, but of course the weather intervened. And as it turned out, Dave, in case you didn't hear the interview, we talked with an organizer for the big day, and she said they had about 1,000 people. People showed up despite
the
weather.
People showed up, yeah.
Let's talk about this Supreme Court decision not to consider North Dakota's voter ID law.
Right, and the appeals court had sided with the state of North Dakota, saying, you know, that these are reasonable things. But the Native Americans have been argue that on reservations, you don't necessarily get a street address. You get a post office box. Well, the state is saying that's not an acceptable address. We need to know what your street address is because what the state says is that there may be some out-of-state interests who may have a post office box in North Dakota, and you just don't know. Well, the Supreme Court just basically let it set, saying we're not going to accept the case at this time. But you notice there's always the proviso at this time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it could come back.
It could come back.
But in the meantime, there is an extra kind of obstacle for people who don't have that ID with a firm, hard, you know, identifiable address, not
right.
A post office box.
Right, and I think there are ways around that, if I remember correctly. But, you know, it makes it a little bit harder to vote. But then again, if you don't have a street address, then it's hard for a poll worker to find out where you are. That's the argument.
The Public Service Commission, Dave, as you reported, has dismissed a complaint concerning that proposed Belfield refinery, the Davis refinery, that would be close to Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
Yes, and what the issue is there, state law says that the PSC is involved in siting if it's 50,000 barrels a day or above. The way the Davis refinery is going to be constructed, it's going to be at the 49,500 level. And the Public Service Commission felt, and the administrative law judge who actually looked at the case first, said the commission's hands are tied because the statute was very clear. As I said, it provides a bright line test, and that bright line test is 50,000 barrels a day.
Well, it does, you know, on the surface, the optics make it look like the refinery project proponents are kind of trying to game the law. Mm-hmm. And so does this perhaps provide some impetus to change the law?
That was the discussion at the Public Service Commission meeting, that the commissioners all believe that there will be a revisit to that siting law based on this case. And according to one of the commissioners, that one of the executives of the oil company basically said, we're building it to 49.5 so we don't have to go through the siting procedure, which may have delayed things a while.
Yeah, that's a 500-barrel difference, so
yeah.
I think that's probably going to miff some lawmakers.
I think it is, and it is not happy with some of the residents around there who worry about the view shed at Theodore Roosevelt Park.
There was a story in the Bismarck Tribune today by Jessica Holdman, Dave, that the Stanton Station power plant has been demolished in a planned implosion, and I guess I look at that as a sign of the times.
It is. The Stanton plant, being one of the older but a very reliable plant, was shut down. And people who worked there were either laid off or given positions within other power plants in the region. But, you know, that's thing. You know, coal is still holding on, and there's still hope for doing some, you know, clean coal projects like the Alum Cycle or like this one plant that's being built in the south to you know, get carbon reduced. But at the time, you've got also these natural gas peaking plants. Wind energy is becoming more and more of a factor in North Dakota, even though wind energy is not considered baseload because the wind doesn't blow all the time. However, there's a lot of wind power going up in North Dakota. So there's quite a bit in the energy mix, and North Dakota's energy policy has been all of the above. And the Stanton Station is one of those things that was kind of a casualty of it. But, you know, I think some of the people went to work at Great River Energy's Coal Creek Station.
Well, you look at the coal industry, which has been a major industry in the United States for a very long time. It appears to be in its decline.
Well, yeah, I think that's very true, because you know we haven't even talked about solar, we haven't even talked about hydropower, and what kind of role they'll play in the energy mix. Plus, there seems to be now a bit more of a push toward bringing back nuclear energy, you know, building more nuclear plants.
Well, there's real concern about the global warming stuff that's coming
out,
because the information keeps getting updated, and the updates are not encouraging.
That's right, and that's why the coal industry is hoping that you can do something with carbon capture and reduce that amount of global warming, and maybe you can use that captured carbon for something like enhanced oil recovery, like it's being done in Saskatchewan right now. And that seems to be potentially a path forward, but you know, to get it where it makes sense economically has been a real challenge.
Dave, you posted a story yesterday that 224 state employees who applied to the voluntary separation program have been approved for buyouts.
Right. They opened the program after the governor said he'd like to see a reduction in the number of state employees by about 5%, and agencies are facing 5-10% budget cuts in at least the first look at the budgets. So they opened this, and a number of state employees decided to take it on. And it's not saying that all those positions are going to be cut or left unfilled. Some agencies will have to refill those positions, but they're going to fill them with newer employees who won't make as much money.
Okay, so the budget issues are still out there.
They're still out there. Even though the Bakken seems to be coming back, there's still some issues with sales tax. And here is the big unknown, and I keep wondering what is going to happen now. And that's the idea of collecting sales taxes, state sales taxes from internet retailers. What is that going to make in terms of how it's going to affect the budget?
All right. Well, let's talk about the midterm elections that are fast approaching, and this is a midterm election cycle for the history book.
It sure is.
We've got measures in the state of North Dakota that are going to attract lots of voters, and we have nationwide attention on the Senate race between incumbent Heidi Heitkamp and Kevin Cramer. And, of course, a week ago tomorrow, Dave, we were supposed to have had a debate between
two
people, which, because of the kerfuffle over Kavanaugh, didn't happen. And now the question is, will it ever happen?
For Prairie Public, that is doubtful. That's the latest thing I have, is that it looks like that's going to be doubtful because of scheduling issues. What I do know is that Senator Heitkamp and Congressman Cramer are going to debate next week, Thursday, in a debate sponsored by the North Dakota Newspaper Association. And then the following Friday, the last Friday of the month, in October 26th, they'll be debating in Fargo for the North Dakota Broadcasters Association. And I can tell you, Doug, that I've been honored because I've been tapped to be the moderator for that debate in Fargo.
Well, congratulations. And let me just suggest that each one of those debates start in the morning and go till night.
They
because
might have
we
to.
Need to hear from these two candidates besides their, you know, their ads on radio and TV and online and all that stuff.
And, of course, you understand there's a lot of money that's being poured into it. It's not just the candidates' ads, but, you know, all these, you know, majority PAC and other PACs and things like this. They're really sucking up a lot of airtime on our commercial brethren's airwaves.
Oh, no kidding. And I'm constantly amazed at who on earth is being moved by any of this.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about another measure, another issue on the ballot. That is measure number three. And that, that is pro or con, I guess, depending on the will of the electorate here to have recreational marijuana in North Dakota. We've had some conversations on Main Street about this, and we have some more coming up. But this is likely to motivate some folks.
I think it's going to motivate a lot of folks to get to the polls. I mean, there still is a lot, and it's palpable. I can say this because I've been talking to a lot of people. There's still some palpable frustration with the legislature when they felt they had to go and change the things about medical marijuana, and medical marijuana is not yet ready to go. So, you know, it's been almost 2 years since that was passed, and there's some frustration there. So a lot of people who supported medical marijuana say, well, let's just go ahead for recreational. And there's a group that does feel that, you know, if you do it for medical marijuana, other states have done recreational marijuana. Why not North Dakota? And there's a feeling that there is a possibly it could pass.
Well, there have been opponents that have developed opponents to measure number three.
The latest one, the North Dakota Association of Counties, has come out as a block saying they oppose because they worry about not having enough controls on it, that North Dakota may have, as some said, the most liberal possession laws in the country because there are no limits on possession of marijuana and growing marijuana, whereas other states do have some limits. And the proponents will come back and say, okay, if we need to tweak this, the legislature can tweak it.
Yes, they have the medical marijuana law.
As they did in medical marijuana, yeah. But it has gotten so much pushback from medical marijuana, you make it wonder if it's once bitten, twice shy.
Well, this is a very, very interesting election season, and I need to remind our listeners, or inform them actually, and you for that matter, that Heidi Heitkamp will be on our show on Main Street Friday. So
excellent.
We're looking forward to that conversation, and of course, Kevin Cramer as well. And these statewide elections, these conversations we get to have on Main Street have been very interesting to me, and I hope they have been to the listeners as well.
Absolutely. Well, I think they're valuable.
Dave, it's always a pleasure to check in with our news director, even if it's a day early.
Well, thank you very much, Doug.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. One of the country's oldest mining companies will be filing Chapter 11 reorganization bankruptcy. Westmoreland operates the Beulah Mine in North Dakota. That mine is a 9,000-acre mine that provides lignite coal to the Coyote Generating Station nearby and to the Heskett Station just north of Mandan.
It's not like the mine is being shut down.
Public Service Commission Chairman Randy Chrisman. The PSC regulates coal mining and reclamation in North Dakota.
We have surety bonds, and hopefully the company is able to work through the bankruptcy proceedings and continue operating. But if not, There are surety bonds in place for future reclamation work there.
The mine has been open since 1963. It produces 2.5 million tons of lignite annually. A big wind farm is planned for Emmons and Logan counties. Public Service Commissioner Julie Fedorchak says the proposal was filed with the commission back in July for the wind farm.
A 298.1-megawatt Emmons-Logan Wind Energy Center consisting of up to 123 wind turbine generators.
Fedorchak says the company has also filed to build a 6.9-mile high-voltage power line. She says the PSC has scheduled a hearing in Linton for December 7th. And it will be a busy athletics-filled weekend on the UND campus this week. The Fighting Hawks football, volleyball, hockey, and cross-country teams will all be in town and in competition. Despite all the activity, the athletes and the UND community are hoping to promote some advocacy and shine light on the issue of violence and abuse.
There's about 10% of people in this world that might commit one of these crimes or these abuses. We want to bring that down to a smaller and make that 90% of people who don't, make that even larger and into, you know, 97 to 100, of course, and make it not happen anymore.
Andres Freeman is with Student Athlete Support Services at UND. He says there will be a visible focus put on the issue this weekend. He says that includes discussions with guest speaker Brenda Tracy.
So Brenda is a sexual assault survivor. She's been touring the country for over the past 2 years now, educating coaches, athletes, students, and just how to be the 90% of the solution. And with that, she visits college campuses with, you know, intent to educate, and she shares her very impactful story. It's a pretty graphic story, but at the same time, very impactful for the students that hear that.
Freeman says this is the second visit to UND in her 2 years of campus touring. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a regular on Main Street. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he's a popular speaker all across the state of North Dakota, and recently the author of the new book about some of his experiences that he shared on Main Street in his Plainsfolk essays titled Pacing Dakota. It's a great book. Well, this week, Tom's Main Street essay is titled The Power of Serving.
It's a natural question for a historian such as I to ask, attending one of our many fine fall suppers of the Northern Plains. How long has this been going on? It is a mark of the folkloristic nature of these events, their traditional dynamics, that no one can give you a good answer. So I commenced a newspaper search for references to fall suppers and fall dinners. The first notice I found was in the Botno Courant, 7 November, 1901. There will be a hot fowl dinner at the Methodist Church next Saturday. Everyone expects to hot foot down to dinner there on that day. Hot fowl dinner at the ME Church beginning at 11:30, price 25 cents. A subsequent notice refers to this 1901 event in Botno as a harvest home dinner. There are things to note about this historical reference. First, it was a hot dinner. This indicates that church meals then more commonly were cold food, which makes sense given limited culinary facilities in churches. Second, it was a Methodist affair. And today, we tend to think of our lavish fall feeds mainly as features of parishes with ethnic immigrant antecedents, mainly Lutheran or Roman Catholic. The churches of the Yankee settlers, mainly in the towns, were Episcopal, Congregational, Presbyterian, or Methodist. It is the Yankee churches that I find noticed in the press for their early fall suppers. So does this mean that they, and not the Lutherans or Catholics, were the pioneers in fall suppering? Well, not so fast. It may well be that the Yankee doings got reported in the newspapers because they were in town and because they spoke English, whereas the ethnics were in the country and spoke some other language than that of the popular press. This wants closer research in parish records. In the meantime, consider this apparently routine notice in the Dickinson Press, November 15, 1913. The Ladies' Aid Society of the Congregational Church will hold their annual fall supper and bazaar on December 4th and 5th. Such notices in papers across the region indicate that at least by the 19-teens, fall suppers were routinely on the calendar, were becoming embedded in regional culture. They also were occasions for social mixing. Witness this note in the Langdon Pioneer Express, October 30th, 1914. A number from Bozemont attended the annual supper given by the ladies of the Presbyterian Church in Pittsburgh Tuesday evening. From this notice, observe the obvious fact that the fall suppers were put on by the women, whereas today mixed crews do the work, and in some cases men are the instigators. If anyone is thinking, then, that these events were cute or marginal activities on the part of the women folk, think again. Fall suppers were intended to raise money, money that met the needs of struggling parishes. Money means power. Women achieved influence through the hard work of serving fall suppers. Today, it's a cliche to talk about servant leadership in public life. Lord knows we need more of it. The church ladies of a century ago understood this.
This is Bill Thomas here in my role as director of radio at Prairie Public. You know, we just finished up our fall membership drive, and if you didn't get a chance to participate, you still can. You can go to prairiepublic.org or you can call 800-359-4145. We're going to keep the thank you gifts around for a little bit if you'd like to participate. But for all who did, thank you so much. We are so appreciative of the many people who responded before the drive, to our mail and phone appeals, and during the drive, to our on-air appeals. We absolutely could not do it without you. It's our most important support, and we appreciate it so much. So, to everyone who contributed, thank you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and Sue Balcom joins us from our microphone in Bismarck.
And this time of year, apples are basically just falling off the tree, ready for any open hands, open mouths.
You can open probably, baskets. Yep. Get out the tankers. Man, there's apples everywhere.
Yeah, when we're not proving gravity, we're eating apples. Huh?
Oh, good point. Yeah. And they're easier to get off the tree, you know, when they're really nice and ripe. They do fall. But if you know anybody who has an apple tree in their backyard, they're always complaining about the mess it is to clean up those fallen apples. So definitely get your kids and volunteer to go pick those. I mean, ask permission. We didn't ask permission when we were kids. We used to, like, just kind of sneak around when dusk came upon us in the fall.
We did wait for dark, yes.
Yes, we did. We did, and then we'd sneak into the yards, and we'd help ourselves to some of the most wonderful apples, which are hard to find now. There were some good crabapple varieties back when I was growing up that I can't find anywhere.
Well, at my house, you would be in a hard-fought battle with turkeys, deer, and raccoons. So you just go ahead, show up at night, see what happens to you.
And that's the challenge of apple season. It's sort of like zucchini season. When it comes, and it really, you get lots of fruit. And what do you do with it?
Well, first of all, they're great fresh. It's always good to eat apples fresh, but not the seeds, because I just learned that they have cyanide in them in small quantities. So you could keep that in the back of your mind if you ever need to maybe get rid of some of those deer. Feed them the seeds, right? Because, you know, an apple a day seriously is good for you because they have fiber, they help lower cholesterol, and they say that people who eat an apple a day actually have an easier time to keep their weight down. They're really full of good nutrients. They're full of some minerals like calcium and potassium, vitamin C. And, of course, you know, if you have a lot of apples, you know, they don't last that long on the counter. But if you refrigerate them, you might have them to eat fresh well into winter. But in the event that you don't want to do that, you know, there's always apple pie and there's German apple cake, which is like the easiest cake in the world, applesauce, caramel apples, apple crisp or caramel apple crisp, and, of course, baked apples. But you can freeze them too. And that's what we do with most of our excess apples is we like to freeze them. So we have them in the wintertime for pie and apple crisp.
And I'll just add too that dehydrated apples are really good.
With a little sugar and cinnamon sprinkled on them. And that's a simple enough thing to do too.
You reminded me, Sue, that, you know, we've got Delicious and Gala and Fuji and Honeycrisp. We got all these commercial apples out there, a lot of variety, I suppose, if you go to the supermarket. But when we were kids, those big crab apples were to die for.
They are. They had kind of a like a wilder taste to them or something. My grandmother actually had this tree that they almost tasted like pears. But she would actually can the whole apple. You know, she would take a quart jar and she'd fill the apples in there and put a simple syrup in there and process them. And I'm, oh my gosh, they were to die for. They were really awesome. And it is hard. We have one old crab apple tree at our house that I actually cooked down for pectin because the older varieties had lots of pectin in them. And that, of course, is a thickener for jams and jellies.
I didn't know that's where that came from.
Yes.
Or
so,
at least could come from that.
Could, right. Most of it, I think, does. If you buy good, like I buy good bulk pectin from an Amish grocery store down south of us here. And that actually, I don't understand sometimes why people wouldn't eat something with pectin in it because it is a natural product. And, of course, some fruits have higher levels of pectin than other fruits do. But here's an interesting thing I learned about crabapple pectin is that you take cook it down and it will start to thicken and then put a tablespoon in a bowl and put a little rubbing alcohol on it. And if it gels up instantly, it's ready to use.
But you're not using, you're not eating the rubbing alcohol.
No, that's the test.
The test. No methanol.
The test, yes. So don't be putting alcohol in anything. Well, unless it's brandy.
There
you go. Brandied apples. Yeah. That sounds good, right?
Ethanol.
Does sound really good.
Ethanol, not methanol. You had in some notes you sent to us, you refer to the German apple cake as the easiest cake in the world. Prove it.
Oh, my gosh, you guys, that cake, you slice up 4 cups of apples, and then you take a little flour and a little sugar and cinnamon and some oil, and you mix it together and throw it in a pan and bake it, and then you put cream cheese frosting over it while it's warm. And I think if you Google German apple cake or go to my website, that recipe can be found quite easily. But it is like the best cake on the planet. And it's, you know, 20 minutes worth of time because I never peel my apples when they come off a tree. And I know that people aren't using pesticides or anything like that. We just use the whole apple with the exception of the core when we're cooking.
Do you ever make hard cider?
No, I did not ever try that. But I do have a friend named Holly who showed some pictures on Facebook of them actually pressing apples. So if you have a great big quantities of apples and you can find an apple press at an auction, oh my gosh, you've got to do that because fresh apple juice is really amazing.
Yeah, I make apple cider every year, but I've never tried to make hard cider.
Me neither, because we don't drink a lot of alcohol at our house, but it sounds interesting enough. And I'm sure it can be fermented just like anything else that's on my counter for a week or two.
Yeah, maybe I can just leave it out.
Just leave it out and see what happens, right?
Well, we've got the caramel apple season coming up, so how do you keep those apples long enough? Or do you just do them right away?
Actually, no. I think that if you have an extra refrigerator or you have a root cellar, then you just need to pick those apples and lay them out on in boxes, probably in flats, so they're not on top of each other, and keep them stored. You can keep them stored till spring at about 40 degrees or lower in a well-ventilated area. The ones in the refrigerator will keep, but they kind of like aren't as good as the ones that are left out in the root cellar. And then, of course, because you've got them laid out on newspaper or in those low boxes that you can get from soda cans, you can pick out the bad ones. And so you go down and inspect them every once in a while and throw the bad ones away. And I have had apples in January that have been just amazing storage apples.
Well, that's a hint, I guess, of how the commercial people do it. They must have warehouses just full of apples because they're they're available year-round.
That's right. And right now would be a good time to go into your store and take a look at some of the varieties of apples that we get that are – they're less expensive now because they are so plentiful.
All right. Well, apples are on the menu, and we check in with Sue Belcom every week.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
What's happening is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we travel to Kansas with President Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson went to Pittsburgh, Kansas, in the southeastern part of that state that Jefferson purchased from Napoleon Bonaparte, and the subject was the Louisiana Purchase.
Yes, and President Jefferson, to begin the conversation, pointed out to the citizens of Kansas that he bought the state for them.
For 3 cents per acre. Dustin Triber of KRPS in Pittsburgh was the host. On your behalf, David, they all asked about you, but this was Thomas Jefferson in the American heartland.
I think it's great for listeners to have the opportunity to hear President Jefferson in front of a live audience. It's a bit different than here in the barn.
The auditorium there, David, was spectacular. I looked out on 500 people who had come to hear from the third president of the United States.
So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, the snow isn't going on anymore. It's out there, but it certainly has changed October and our activity list a little bit. I mean, we're probably sort of leaning toward inside right now, but Ashley Thornburg and I look at our calendar of things to do on an October weekend.
And I know it's very easy to just try and go straight into hibernation. I am fighting that myself. So I'm going to propose a high-energy chamber music ensemble. So this is called Project Trio. It's coming up tomorrow, the 12th, in Moorhead at Concordia College. This is a musical experience full of passionate people who are performing on the cello, the flute, and the bass. And this is, again, like I said, just described as high energy, eclectic taste in musical style that sort of meets the classical training. So one of these sort of crossover groups. This gets going at 7:30 on Friday in Moorhead at the Christensen Recital Hall on the campus of Concordia College. Tickets are $20, or if you are under 18, they're just $10.
Well, here's another musical event. This one's titled Considering Matthew Shepard. It's performed in concert on Friday at the Festival Concert Hall. Of course, that's at NDSU. In October of 1998, Matthew Shepard, a young gay student at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, was kidnapped. He was severely beaten, tied to a fence, and left to die. 5 days later, when he passed away, the world was watching, and on the eve of the 20th anniversary, Craig Hella Johnson has responded with his first concert-length work. It's titled Considering Matthew Shepard. Again, it's at Festival Concert Hall at NDSU on Friday at 7:30 Central Time. It costs $25.
There's going to be a documentary film screening on Sunday the 14th in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. And this is a screening of the film Far From the Tree. It is at 2 o'clock on Sunday the 14th. This is based on the book by New York Times bestselling author Andrew Solomon. He is one of the Game Changer ND speakers. And so this is that Game Changer event, which, by the way, is Saturday in Bismarck all day long. It has a bunch of speakers that are talking about life and death, and Andrew Solomon's specifically examines the ways that parents and children are profoundly different from one another, despite being, you know, from that same tree. So again, this is showing at 2 o'clock on the 14th in Bismarck at the Heritage Center and State Museum, and it's free.
Well, also in Bismarck, the Fall STEM Spectacular at the Francis Leach High Prairie Arts and Science Complex on Saturday. Gateway to Science, North Dakota's hands-on science center, will present Fall STEM Spectacular. This free event will feature chemistry, health and wellness, escape challenges, and engineering design challenges for all ages. Gateway to Science members will have early access beginning at 12:30, and doors will open for the general public from 1 to 4 in the afternoon on Saturday. STEM Spectacular events are presented in an open house format where guests can proceed through the activities at their own pace. Again, it runs from 1 to 4 on Saturday afternoon at the Francis Leach High Prairie Arts and Science Complex. The Gateway to Science members can get in a half hour early. The cost is free.
Minot State University's Theater Arts Department has a performance going on this weekend, actually starting today and running through Saturday at the Aylshire Theater. And their fall production is Almost Maine. And this is smart. It's funny. It's easy to relate to this show. It's about best friends who are finding their true love and then love lost. We've all been there, right? So you can check this out Thursday through Saturday in Minot at the Aylshire Theater on the campus of Minot State University. Evening performances at 7:30, and tickets are $10.
Well, there's a reason it's a favorite among theater programs across the country. Almost Maine is very, very popular with audiences. The Promised Land Project presents America's Front Porch on Sunday in Watford City at the Rough Rider Center. You can join them for an afternoon of inspiration, socializing, and entertainment, bringing America together on common ground issues to take everybody to higher ground, we hope. Everyone's welcome at this free event to enjoy spending time with your friends and getting to know your neighbors over a good meal while enjoying engaging front porch conversations with musical performances by Tiger Lily and Nashville's Mama Dear, the band Rolling Stone called country music's best up-and-comer. So a big day in Watford City on Sunday at the Rough Rider Center. It runs from 3 in the afternoon till 6:30 in the evening. The Promised Land Project presents America's Front Porch. It's free.
All right, my pick of the week is pianist Sarah Cahill performing in Grand Forks at the North Dakota Museum of Art on Sunday the 14th. This is a performance called The Future is Female, and she is going to be performing more than 40 compositions by women from around the globe, ranging from the 15th century to now. And get this, this is a marathon performance. She's probably going to be playing for 3, 4, maybe even longer than that, hours of just working that piano. This is, again, at the Grand Forks North Dakota Museum of Art. It gets going at 2 o'clock, and tickets are anywhere from free to $25.
My pick is the open house today for Bob Dambeck. He's the retiring head of Prairie Public's television service. It runs from 5:30 to 7:30 in the television studio in downtown Fargo. I got to go down 3 flights of stairs. There will be a short program at 6 o'clock and yummy appetizers. Again, it's in the studio, the television studio for Prairie Public, downtown Fargo. And everybody's invited. If you hear this, you're invited. No RSVP required. And that's what's happening.
Programming is supported by the Fargo Public Library, presenting their Fall Into Jazz Concerts, featuring local jazz artists. Concerts are Sundays in October, starting at 2 p.m. at the downtown Main Library. More information at fargolibrary.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 11th. North Dakota remembers World War I. On this date, in 1917, Europe was at war. America had not yet joined the fight, but there was another war to be waged, the war against hunger. Europe was woefully short of food. Herbert Hoover, the food administrator, announced that the United States could do a great deal to help the European allies, suggesting that Americans eat less of the foods that could be shipped to Europe and more of the perishable foods that could not. The food administrator position was established by the Lever Act. Critics of the law were concerned that the food administrator was given too much power to make sweeping decisions on his own, but President Wilson was able to push the law through. Hoover's job was to oversee the use of agricultural products.
He had the authority to fix food prices, license distributors, coordinate purchases, oversee exports, act against hoarding and profiteering, and incentivize farmers to grow more crops. In support of the effort to help the Allies, the Hope Pioneer newspaper urged North Dakotans to enlist in the food conservation movement. Europe needed bread and butter as well as beef, pork, sugar, and dairy products. American housewives were called upon to do their part to make the world safe for democracy. To that end, the Food Pledge campaign was scheduled to open on October 21st and run for 1 week. All housewives were asked to sign the pledge. The campaign required no dues or contributions. All that was needed was a signature. The signer pledged to carry out the directions and advice of the food administrator. The signature on the pledge card was a promise to the federal government that North Dakotans were in support of the United States and our allies. Across the country, states took steps to comply with the food conservation movement. The article in the Hope Pioneer argued that North Dakota bore a notable responsibility to make the program a success, since, except for sugar, every food item on the list was produced in the state. The article said North Dakota's contribution to the war effort could be extra large if each of the state's 138,000 families would carefully conserve. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a consumer-owned power cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with nearly 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
One voter in a poor Kentucky county says she is doing well under President Trump, and she says those still in poverty should work their way out.
There's some people that are just so lazy. It just kills me, just because I do work for everything I have.
Her vote in November could help determine control of the House, a view of the midterms from three corners of a Kentucky district. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
But we want to thank all of those of you who participated in our membership campaign this week because, of course, that's how Prairie Public stays on the air. That's how Main Street stays on the air. So for those of you who made that call, and if you forgot the number and would like to make that call, it's 800-359-4145. Or you can go online to prairiepublic.org and click the Donate Now button on the right upper-hand corner of the screen. And we can share some great news about one of those people who participated in our campaign. We have our Amazon gift card winner. She's been a sustaining member since 2013. She lives in Minot and prefers to remain anonymous, but she volunteers working at the food pantry there, which feeds 700 families. So congratulations to you. Friday on Main Street, North Dakota has one of the hottest Senate races in the country. In September, we heard from Republican Congressman Kevin Cramer, who wants Heidi Heitkamp's seat. And on Friday, we'll hear from the Democratic incumbent, Ms. Heitkamp. We'll also talk about the Center for Public Integrity's new story about obstacles to voting for residents on the Standing Rock Reservation. And Matt Olien will offer a new movie review. On Friday, he reviews the movie Venom. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.